Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. We've got a record 6 different segments this morning. We're going to take you all over the state. We'll visit artist studios, meet recently inaugurated Norwich University President Mark Anarumo. We'll check in with Bob Ney, learn about the state's first black sheriff and police chief, and we're going to finish on one of those chilling Queen City ghost walks. Where do we begin this magical journey? Picking potatoes. This event happens just one day a year, and I'd be absolutely failing you in my quest to make sure you know everything about and everything that's happening in Vermont. So let's head back to Billtown and hear about Sunday's Pick Your Own Potato event at Chappelle's Vermont Potatoes from owner Bob Chappelle, Barb Chappelle. Barb, thanks so much for being on this morning.
Thank you, Rick.
I'm getting so excited about potato picking. All right. How long have you been in the potato business?
Oh, it's pretty close to 45 years now.
Wow. What got you into it in the first place?
It was just a fluke. We bought an old, dilapidated farm, and our neighbor grew a few potatoes to pay his taxes. And the minute my husband saw those potatoes coming out of the ground, he was hooked.
Now, I understand you gave up a massive radio career for a career in the potato business.
No, it didn't quite work like that. It wasn't a massive career, and it was several years after that we started the potatoes, so you can't blame it on that.
All right. Well, you're back in the radio biz this morning, and we're glad to have you. Now, give us an idea of how much land you have developed, you know, devoted to potatoes, how many different varieties you grow.
Well, as far as land goes, we have, I guess the most potatoes we've planted have been on 60 acres. And because we rotate our crops every year, we have to have twice as many fields as we have planted in potatoes. And then the following year, they're planted in a cover crop. And a lot of that land is rented and is being sold. People are buying it. So we're reducing that. This year, we're down to 36 acres. And what was your other question?
How many different varieties do you grow?
Oh, varieties. Well, we basically, for the potatoes that we sell to people and to grocery stores, is we sell a white variety, one white variety, and then we have an assortment of red and yellow potatoes. I mean, they aren't red and yellow. Some are red and some are yellow flesh. Mm-hmm. But we also grow sell about 35 different varieties of seed potatoes to a lot of market gardeners and other people, anybody that wants to buy them. We don't grow all of them. We bring some of them in from growers in Maine and New York.
Mm. Now, when did the one-day pick-your-own event get started?
That is how we started doing anything with potatoes. Uh-huh. And we lived in West Corinth, literally in the middle of nowhere on the way to nothing. And we just, we had grown, I forget what it was, maybe half an acre. We just put up signs that said potatoes with arrows on it. And we couldn't believe how many people we had from all over. We had people show up from Boston in their patent leather shoes and their fancy, you know, Sunday go-to-meeting clothes, and they were just out for a Sunday drive and showed up. And a lot of those people became regular customers, and some of them now are still coming and bringing their grandchildren and their children and stuff like that. It's just been, it's been wonderful. We get to meet so many people.
Oh, I love it. So about how many pounds of potatoes get picked on this day each year?
Ooh. I can't tell you. I just don't know. It's
right.
A lot. It's thousands of pounds. And
wow.
They don't just get picked by the people that our customers, we dig the potatoes and we lay them out on the ground, and we tell people they can pick up whatever they want. They don't have to pick the row clean. And about 98% of those people are looking for really big potatoes. So then we pay some high school kids or junior high to pick up what's left behind. And there's always a lot. One year we filled two potato harvesting trucks with what was left behind.
Oh, my.
So it's... I can't tell you.
Yeah.
Maybe my husband could, but I just can't tell you that.
And it's at 40 cents a pound, right, when people come this weekend on Sunday?
Yeah.
What are the hours? Care.
What's that?
What are the hours?
Okay. We say we start at, our ad says we start at 9 and end at 4, but we have some regulars who show up, and I guess they just like to watch us set up and everything. They happily sit there and wait until we're ready to dig. So there is no advantage to coming early because we dig all day long as people need potatoes dug.
Gotcha.
And that's about all you need to know. Most people bring a sheetrock pail.
Okay.
To dig into.
Yep.
And that'll hold about 22 pounds. And we supply grain bags that they can dump, you know, if they're buying a couple hundred pounds. They can have as many bags as they want.
Mm.
But we don't care how much they pick up. We've had people come with little plastic grocery bags, which I do not recommend.
Right.
And they might pick up, you know, 3 or 4 pounds. And we've had a family that had something like 6 or 7 boys drive in with a flatbed, and they'd pick up 2 tons.
Wow.
So,
do people need to bring any implements? You said a bucket, but anything else?
Yeah. Nope, just a bucket.
All right. And, you know, I'm all about fashion. You mentioned people who show up in their Sunday best, but what should people wear if they're going to be out there digging?
Well, what they ought to, if we have snow, which has happened, or if we have a heavy rain, we cannot dig. The machinery just slides around and it's hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I would recommend, I don't know, we have some people that pretty much stay all day because my daughter-in-law is also offering fresh as you can get them, French fries and mm-hmm. hamburgers and stuff like that. And some people just come for the food. But what you ought to do is just, I mean, it doesn't matter what you wear, just maybe bring a layer of clothing in case you get there and it's cold, or, you know, something you could take off if it's too warm.
Is there a rain date or a snow date?
Well, we have done that before, but we can't this year. We have our potatoes planted so late that we have to get them out of the ground before snow flies.
All right. Sunday is the day for the pick your own potatoes at Chappelle's. All right. Anything else that people should know about Sunday's event, the pick your own potato day at Chappelle's?
I don't think so. I think you covered it all.
All right. Is this fun for you when you have
it? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We love seeing all the people, and they're so much having fun, and the kids are having fun. Yeah, it's really great.
All right. Pick your own potatoes this Sunday at Chappelle's Vermont Potatoes in Williamstown from 9-ish to 4-ish. It's 3242 South Hill Road. And Barb, I want to thank you so much for getting us excited about the spuds.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Take care. Have a great
Bye-bye.
Sunday. Okay. We talked spuds. Now here's something else you can do this weekend, both Saturday and Sunday. It's the Fall Open Studio Weekend, and it is a great way to get around the state, to take in some fall foliage, also to meet some of Vermont's many artists and to be exposed to their creations. Joining us to discuss this weekend is Steve Bronstein. He is from Black Forge in Marshfield. Steve, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
Oh, great having you. And we also have Alyssa Campbell of Blue Roof Designs in Montpelier. Alyssa, thanks for being on the program.
morning.
Morning. All right, listeners, to ask our guests about the weekend, or maybe you want to share some artist work you found on one of these weekends, you can call us at 877-291-8255 or 244-1777. All right, I love the contrast of creations we have from the two artists who are on with me. Alyssa, first of all, tell us what you create at Blue Roof Designs.
Oh, well, I am a book artist. I mostly make blank books, so journals and photo albums. I make wearable book necklaces and ornaments with little books on them as well. And then I make books with content, so different structures that tell stories about my own personal life or experiences I've had. And yeah, I guess that's about it.
And how did this become something that you started creating?
Oh, well, when I was in graduate school for art therapy, there was a paper store in between my apartment and where I would take classes, and I had a help wanted sign in the window, and I thought, well, I guess I could work at a paper store. And that was just the beginning of the end. They taught me all about paper. I started taking bookmaking classes there, and I just absolutely fell in love with the craft.
And describe a book that you would create for someone.
Oh, well, I've had people bring me, I had somebody who brought me a bunch of emails from their first year of marriage, because the first year of marriage is paper, the anniversary. Mm. So I would bind that into a book for them. And I've done guest books for weddings. That's also been something that I've done, things that they could put photos in, you know, with a little instant camera they might have available, or, yeah.
All right. So from the delicate and the soft, we go to items that are forged by fire. And Steve, what is it that you create?
My shop is called, the business is called Black Point Forge, and I'm a blacksmith, which is sort of weird in the 21st century, but I've been doing this for 40 years, and wow. Luckily there's still a place for blacksmiths today. It's interesting that it's a range from, there are less of them, but I still get farmers bringing their tractors to my dooryard for me to fix things on them, and I get, you know, do repairs, and then that's a small sideline. That used to be what blacksmiths did a lot of. Mostly what I do now is make home accessories. I'm looking in the gallery, my little shop. I have clocks and vases and garden sculpture, kitchen utensils, cheese knives. Basically anything that's an ornament within the home is something that I'm interested in creating. We have fireplace sets, so it's from sort of functional craft to fine art, just beautiful things to have in your home.
Mm-hmm. And Steve, you know, why was metalwork what you gravitated towards rather than, say, bookbinding?
You know, it's interesting. It was not a life plan. So I graduated from college with a bachelor's in science, and I was a lab tech at UVM. Mm. And just while working there as a hobby, I started woodworking, and I had a wood lathe, and I needed a weird shaped chisel, which I couldn't buy. So this was before the internet. You went to the library. I got a book on making tools, which was essentially a blacksmithing book, though I didn't realize it at the time. And then if you remember UVM, there was the Church Street Center on Church Street, which was a continuing ed program. And there was a blacksmith in Wakefield who had a weekend workshop. I took it, made a poker, thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever done in my life, and changed majors. And with that poker, I got a job at the Shelburne Museum, which allowed me sort of on-the-job training. And then I figured out there was this world of crafts and started going to craft fairs and practiced being a blacksmith every day. I had my books, and I'd go out to the shop and struggle and make mistakes and figure it out, and I'm still doing that, and I'm still having a great time.
Oh, two great stories. Alyssa, now we have this open studio weekend this weekend. What do you enjoy about these weekends?
Oh, well, first of all, I love when people bring kids because they're so curious and they ask the best questions. They don't hold back. And I love the educational piece of it, which is kind of sharing what happens behind the scenes, what they don't see when they just go into a gallery and buy a finished product. So showing them things in different stages, showing them all of the different papers and other materials that I have in my tools. I love sharing my tools, as I imagine Steve must also enjoy. Demonstrating. I have a big library of books about bookminding. I'm happy if someone wants to camp out all afternoon and just go through those. If they're interested in the craft and want to learn themselves, that's totally fine with me.
What are the tools of bookbinding, Alyssa?
Oh, okay. Well, I use an X-Acto knife a lot, an awl for poking holes. The big one is called a bone folder, and it's made out of cow bone. It's kind of shaped like a letter opener, and it helps make sharp creases on paper. So if you fold a piece of paper in half and you push down on it with the bone folder, it gets it nice and sharp. So if you're into origami, it's a really great tool to have.
All right, Steve, what will you be creating as people stop by this weekend?
Well, in fact, one of the exciting things for this weekend is I have a young apprentice. He's 16, Cody Smith, and he's been learning blacksmithing. So I've been working with him on some projects that he can use to demonstrate. So he's really great at making hooks. And then to something a little more sculptural, he's been making these little herons, and they're just beautiful. So, you know, it is this amazing thing that it's in modern times, things appear in our homes. You call Amazon, you go to the store and stick, you pull it out of a box and it's there. And we forget, how do things get made? And the Craft Artist Vermont, what we do is we make things, which is an exceptional activity that people don't really connect to. And this open studio is a way for people to go to artist studios, see how they do their work. And in a lot of ways, it's not what they expect. And I think part of it is it's hard, you know, that you see that it doesn't just happen. There's, like anything you create, there's a little bit of struggle. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's actually the best part of it, that you do this little bit of struggle and you work out technique and you figure out how to do things and you have this vision in your head and then it happens. And when you come to my shop and the list shop and all the other artists around the state, that's really what you get to see. This process from vision to putting that thought into your hands to the material. The material makes it happen, and then our visitors get to bring those things home for wedding presents and birthdays and making their homes beautiful. So that's, I love sharing that. And I love people getting to see, like Alyssa said, see the process, see the tools. It's alien. Most people haven't been to a blacksmith shop.
Yeah.
Most of my tools are from the 1800s, and they still work very well. And luckily, I've got a lot of them to share.
Wow. And if I'm not mistaken, your shop is right there on Route 2. So do you normally get people stopping in to see your work?
I do get people stopped. Often there isn't a sign out. There's no open sign. Most of the time I'm busy working, making things and filling orders. And that's what's open studio is the day that you know that the artists are receiving. We're happy to have visitors. The shop is clean, which is not a normal thing. It's very accessible. I have work on display. Right, listen, normally it's a hurricane. And that's just how we work. But today, or you know, Saturday and Sunday, it will be neat and tidy. And in fact, things will be on display. Often, as I'm making things, they're going out. I'm shipping them out to craft shops and galleries around the country. So this weekend, I have the shelves filled. So now is really the best time to see what it is I make. And all, like I said, all the other artists who are doing open studio, that's what they'll be doing too.
Alyssa, you getting your place all gussied up for visitors this weekend?
Yeah, that's what I was doing right before the call. it's all I had on my date book this week. Clean studio, clean studio.
All right. Well, we know that, you know, if things aren't exactly so at both Blue Roof Designs and at Blackthorn Forge, please excuse our guests because they had to jump on this call. Alyssa, have you been able to take part as a spectator in any of these open studio weekends in the past?
Yeah, actually, I did in the spring because I didn't participate just because of where COVID was at. So I did visit some studios, and it was so exciting because I've been participating for so many years. I've never had the chance to go on the tour. So once I knew I wasn't participating back in the spring, I told my husband, I said, guess what we're doing this week? And it wasn't really a request. It was sort of a, this is what we're doing.
Oh, I love it. Where did you go?
We went to Daryl Storr's studio. She is a printmaker. And we went to Jean Meinhardt. She is a potter. I have both of their work and got more.
Steve, if you could go, if you could get out, what kind of artist studio would you visit?
Well, actually, I have been. One year I didn't do it, and my family and I went to tour. In fact, once my daughter and my wife went to Alyssa's studio and had a great time.
Oh, wow.
It's like a busman's holiday. I went, mm-hmm. There was a blacksmith in Walden whose shop I had never been to, so I was able to go that day and see him in his space. I went to a glass blower in Hardwick. It is, you know, even for me, who I work with my hands every day, you go into somebody else's space and you see not just, you know, the beautiful things they make, but how their shop is set up. Like, mm-hmm. I find that fascinating, and how they move between their material and their work surfaces, and just I find it rather exciting. And then you hear their story.
Yeah.
That's the thing we don't talk about a lot, is the story of how people do what they do is maybe as important as the thing itself.
Right.
And when you go to the studio, you get their stories. And that's the part that you take home with you. So when you know, I may just make a simple hook. You know, it's prosaic. You hang your coat on it. You may forget about it. And then you remember, oh, I got that when I visited Steve at his shop, and he told me this. And I have visitors who come back, you know, regularly. And it's clear they remember things, that it has an impact. So I just want to encourage folks to, you can go online, it's VermontCrafts.com. There you can get a map, find out where there are artists in your area, go get out of your area, get off, like I'm on Route 2, so it's actually easy for people to stop, and there's a lot of great artists out on some back roads. Mm-hmm. That's the adventure. Go down that dirt road that you haven't been on, go to that artist place, and it's a treasure that's hidden out in the woods, and it's really worth the trip.
Well, that's fantastic. That's Steve Bronstein. He owns Blackthorn Forge in Marshfield, and we've been talking with Alyssa Campbell, who owns Blue Roof Designs in Montpelier. And as Steve said, to learn more about the Fall Open Studio Weekend, go to VermontCrafts.com. Alyssa, Steve, thanks for being on with us, and have a great weekend. I know you will.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care. Bye-bye. We're going to take a break for news and then return to meet Norwich University President Mark Anarumo. And tonight on WDEV, the Sox move on to Washington to finish the season against the Nats. Our coverage begins at 6:05. Game time is 7:05. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. It was 1819 when Captain Alden Partridge founded the American Literary Scientific and Military Academy in Norwich, Vermont. After a stop in Middletown, Connecticut, on the campus that is now Wesleyan University, the academy relocated to Northfield, and it is now known as Norwich University. In 1916, Norwich became the site of the first senior ROTC cavalry unit. And last week, another milestone in the school's history occurred when Dr. Mark Anarumo was inaugurated as the school's 24th president. He joins us now. President Anarumo, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks very much, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question or a comment for Mark Anarumo, give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Mark, can you give us a little idea of your background before becoming president at Norwich?
Sure. I enlisted in the Army when I was 16 years old out of New Jersey. When the Army went to college and a GI Bill later, and went to the Air Force as an officer, and the Air Force funded me to get a master's, a PhD, and a postdoc. I had a few stops in higher ed on 1 to 2 year tours and worked through the academic ranks. And before coming to Norwich, I was the director and permanent professor of a leadership center at the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs.
I know the inauguration was last week, but how long have you been serving in the role of president now at Norwich?
I arrived in May of 2020, had a wonderful, very deliberate, and very polished handover with our 28-year serving previous president, Richard Schneider. And then we did a formal changeover on June 1st.
And what has it been like leading a university through a pandemic?
Well,
fun, I'm sure.
I wanted to start. You know, I was joking with our Board of Trustees chairman that this wasn't in the recruitment brochure.
No, it wasn't.
It's been very, very difficult. But, you know, Norwich have done, we have done very, very well. And one of the reasons we've done so well is, you know, the Vermont Association of Independent Colleges, it's called AVIC. We've done it together. And it's been really phenomenal to see that community and that group of Vermont Independent Colleges really get through it together as one kind of team. So it's been difficult, but Norwich has done very, very well. We've made the national news several times for mm-hmm. how we prioritize student mental health and family and financial situations over our own kind of fiscal operations. So it has gone well. We've maintained a safe campus. Right now we have no positive cases. We're doing surveillance testing. We mandated a vaccine. We were one of the first to do so all the way back last May. So we've kept a safe environment. The priority, of course, is to keep in-person instruction going. And right now we're able to do so. So I'm very proud of how the school has done.
What were the biggest challenges, most difficult decisions you've made during that time?
Well, it was probably when we had to go to a in-room quarantine situation. Yeah. You know, last fall, in the fall of 20, I should say, we had I think 16 cases overall, never more than three at one time. And then when we had folks that came back in January for the spring term, they brought the virus with them. And we had 32 cases upon arrival, and that became 60, became 90 very quickly. So how could we save the semester? And we worked with the Vermont Department of Health and our medical experts. And we decided, you know, we're going to have to go to this in-room quarantine situation, which is terrible for student mental health of that age. And that's where we decided, just to maintain mental health and to do the right thing for the students and not make them feel like they were compelled to stay, we incentivized departures and we refunded money for all those who cared to study from home so they weren't isolated on campus. And a major financial hit, but the right thing to do. And we wound up having a very healthy campus environment in the most difficult time.
What have you learned during the pandemic that might help Norwich in the future?
That's an interesting question. I would say that the community of Central Vermont, so we're an international school, we're an international brand. We have an incredible presence overseas, and we host students from around the world. But we have this incredible local connection that I think before I arrived, I may be underappreciated. So how to leverage and how to explore our partnerships locally is something I'm looking to do in the future much more aggressively and in a much more wider sense.
Now, President Anarumo, I believe you moved into a dorm. Am I right about that?
Yeah, we have two lifestyles. We have cadets on campus and our military lifestyle, and we have civilians in our traditional civilian campus environment. I lived for a week in each during the lockdown, yes.
right. And did everyone, like, behave better when they knew you were around, you were in the house?
Yeah. Funny question, because I gave a few rules trying to find the room, that I must not displace anyone, because then it's a terrible thing for the president to do.
Right.
And it had to be a single, because I didn't want to burden one of these students with me living in a room with them, obviously.
Yeah.
So I found the only remaining single on campus, which I figured out in the first 10 minutes why it was a single. It was next to the bathroom in the cinder block old barracks building. And I got to listen to the kids' conversations. They don't go take a shower anymore without a giant Bluetooth speaker. And I learned their music. But I did it very quietly. I didn't want it to be performative, because then it's not authentic, right? So I actually just wanted to do it and have the food delivered and be very quiet about it. But, you know, I kind of was quiet until I arrived, and then I was unloading the car, because I did. I stayed in the room. I only left to use the bathroom, which was our quarantine rules. And I got to really experience it as the students did, instead of as the president living in the dorm, which would have been a much different experience, right?
Yeah.
But your behavior question is funny, because yeah, they're generally, the dorm environment is what it is, but the music changed.
Yeah.
I joked with someone recently, you know, they would play their current music, which is definitely not my style.
Sure.
And then when they realized I was in the room just from food delivery, they started to change the music. And the funniest thing was, they started playing like 1950s doo-wop music. And I opened the door. I said, "You guys, I'm not that old. I'm a 51-year-old man. I'm not, you know, my father, that was aged out when my father was your age." So it was funny, their perspective of age, I guess.
So what would have been the right music to play? What band would have really scored points with you if they played your favorites?
Yeah, you know, I like, you know, classic rock, electric blues. I would say my big three are Eric Clapton, Robert Cray, who's the best artist that not enough people know about, and Stevie Ray Vaughan, that kind of probably 70s, 80s, 90s electric blues music.
All right, well done. Now, you've been at a number of different schools, from Rutgers, Michigan State, Harvard, the Air Force Academy. I'm not asking you to compare Norwich to those schools, but what is it that Norwich offers that you think is unique and well-suited for attracting students and cadets here?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question, because I did bring with me some experience in very, very diverse universities, large research one or R1 universities, publics, a couple of small privates, of course, the Service Academy. And I really believe the Norwich model is the best. And it's a reason I was a finalist for several president jobs when I was out interviewing, and I declined one. Because when I was selected, because I'm a finalist for Norwich, and I just believe in the mission so passionately. You know, our size gives us great advantage. We were at 2,500 undergraduates and about 1,200 that are in the online environment in various ways. It makes us incredibly agile, and we can modernize curriculum, ensure relevancy, bring in new programs, and give experiences on our campus that really don't happen anywhere else. And it's really remarkable. The mix of our civilian and cadet population. We strive for a 2-to-1 ratio, 2 in a military lifestyle to everyone in the civilian lifestyle. But they work in such complementary fashion, it's really stunning. And most of our military students do not go to serve on active duty. They go to other industries, and they immediately lead because of the lifestyle and experiences that we give them here at Norwich University. So the agility, you know, the size is ideal, and we get pressured sometimes, oh, we should have more. But the more we have, the less intimacy and the less agility we'll be able to achieve. So it's a very deliberate model. And the fact that we articulate that we are a values-based institution, we really focus on service above individual advancement and the community. It's a, you know, I love the intro. Since 1819, it's been the model, and it's worked great always. It's worked better at sometimes, and right now it's the perfect model for American higher ed.
Now, President Anarumo, Norwich, as we mentioned before the break, one of the few schools in the country that combines a student body of cadets and civilian students. So what is the advantage to having that combination? What are the challenges that that presents?
Well, the advantages far outweigh the challenges, right? And I think we're past the challenge phase of it. When the decision was made to offer a residential civilian experience and lifestyle here on campus, there was some pushback, especially from alumni who were very passionate about preserving the identity of the school. So President Schneider, my predecessor, did a great job in explaining why this is beneficial, and that even if they are going to be in the military, there's a great advantage to learning how to work alongside civilians, because that is the military environment. The government service is all about the mix of uniform and civilian. So the advantages are profound. And I think the challenges, like I said, have already been passed. We want to make sure. So my job is to make sure all students feel valued, that they have an experience that is worth their investment, and they get the return on that investment, and that they have the best possible experience academically and in the student experience portion of their life, their time here on campus. So the variety, and it's funny because even the civilian students, we're still a values-based institution. They still learn about integrity and service before self. And we have a civic scholars program that the other night, just what we do out in the community is unbelievable. In just a local community, state, national, and international, you know, we're starting to build an orphanage in Tanzania. And the mix of students that would stand there in uniform or in civilian clothing, because they're Norwich students, period, it was stunning. So it's the challenges, I believe, are past. We're now into just reaping the benefits phase.
So who is the student who will find this school to be the right fit for them?
Well, we are an experiential learning environment. So we have world-class faculty. I would stack our faculty against any university in the world. So the classroom instruction is incredible. And then you move then to our student experience, the hands-on learning that augments classroom instruction. And that's where Norwich is really unique. And I believe this resonates with Gen Z who's entering. They're all about hands-on learning and hands-on experience. And I'll give you a quick example. Mm-hmm. We were trying to figure out COVID in the early phases, how we could detect it more efficiently, make sure we weren't missing, because we were about the local community, which is on the older side. We didn't want to put anyone at risk. So the students figured out a way to sample the water in the sewer system, the wastewater. They made the auto samplers, the students did. They brought it up, and then we had a faculty member who created a way to evaluate the wastewater to look for viral shedding. And that was a student-led initiative that now we're exporting to send overseas for military or civilian presence overseas to detect all kinds of viruses in wastewater, just so we can track our own public health, even remotely. So if you hands-on learning, the intimacy of the classroom, we have small classes, and the ability to move back and forth to a lifestyle. If you want to try out the Corps of Cadets, we believe is transformatively positive. Our graduates outperform every institution like us, over presence in all industries. And then if it doesn't work, you could be a civilian. If you're a civilian that wants to come to the Corps and try out that lifestyle, we have facilitations for that. So It's the intimacy of the environment, experience of learning, and really grasping that values-based education.
You've been there now a year and a half. So what goals do you have for Norwich in the near future and then in the more long term?
Yeah, the near future is really establishing additional pipelines for recruiting and students. I mean, as you know, New England and the Northeast is our traditional recruiting hotbed, and the population here is declining, especially of college-age students, so those graduating high school. So the near term for me is really getting out, building new recruiting pipelines. We're an international brand, but we need a more wide geographic representation on campus and more international students, which we're already getting after. So very early in the initiative will be that, just building new recruiting pipelines. Also making sure we're actually writing our strategic plan. The entire plan is based upon student success. So our model is going to be, if you get into Norwich and you get on campus, you're going to be successful, and really rebuilding the organization to make sure I can fulfill that promise. And the internationalization, though, I want to touch on just once again. We're already in partnership with several nations that send some of their best and brightest to Norwich, and they go out into the world and do great things. A lot of people don't know, the president of the nation of Panama is a Norwich University undergraduate. And we have that kind of presence around, especially East and Southeast Asia as well. So that would be my short term, and then building our 10-year plan to make sure we're viable and thriving into the future is my immediate and interim goals.
Now, this is a pretty far back, but I did some research and learned that another Norwich University grad is William Rutherford Mead of the noted architectural firm McKim Mead and White, which really impressed me. And I know that goes back probably 100 years, but just one more great grad from Norwich University. I hate to have to remind you and everyone of the small colleges that have closed recently in Vermont, throughout New England, but it is a sad reality. Why is Norwich better placed, or is it, to weather these difficult times that schools have been forced to close in?
Yeah, well, we're very specific in mission, and we're very unique. So there are six senior military colleges, and just the University of North Georgia is the least known because it's Army only. But then Texas A&M, Virginia Tech, Citadel, VMI are the other five, and Norwich is the other. We were the first, and we are the model that others had had built upon. Mm-hmm. But we're also the only one in the North, which is very interesting. And now that we have a presence in Denver, Colorado, we're the only one in the West. And that opportunity, the lifestyle that it offers, and the access that it offers to government service and uniform service and other industries, it's a very specific identity for a college. And there are only six of us. And that's appealing to a lot of young men and women right now. And it's especially appealing to this generation that's called Gen Z moving into college age. So, yes, the demographic threat of the many, many small colleges throughout New England, it is sad, but it will be a very difficult time in the near future. But we are uniquely positioned because we are so unique. And that's why we have to embrace our brand. And I'm proud of it. Our graduates are very proud of it. And we'll make sure it perpetuates.
And we have a couple minutes left, but I've had several interviews with people from Norwich University, from the Center for Global Resilience and Security. So talk about that program, that center, and why that, again, kind of differentiates Norwich.
Sure. Yeah, and I imagine you interviewed our director, Dr. Tara Kulkarni, mm-hmm. who is just an amazing professional, and I think she's just we're so fortunate that we have her here, and I'm so proud of her. So we have center models, and there's fascinating ways you can get at structure and culture and agility and all those kind of things. So we have our academic departments who do an amazing job delivering the degree requirements and making sure our students are successful and thriving and are prepared for the world. And we have actually three centers of excellence, and we're building a fourth one right now. We have the Global Resiliency and Security that you just referenced. We have a Peace and War Center ran by Dr. Travis Morris, who's another phenomenal professional. We have Dr. Hugh Reed runs our Cyber Center as our third, and our fourth one will be a Leadership Center that we're currently building. So those centers bring in, really cutting-edge, relevant, emerging philosophies, technologies, capabilities, and problem-solving techniques to make sure our students are best prepared as possible leaving the door. And we have this incredible organization called a Board of Fellows. Most schools have something similar, but our graduates in all industries come back. They'll advise the centers and the academic departments. This is what the industries need that you're graduating students into. Then we can adapt the experience and the curriculum to make sure they're getting what – it's funny because if you're a hiring official or a company – you want a certain skill set, mm-hmm. and they've been telling higher ed what they need for a long time, and higher ed doesn't always listen. So we make sure we listen to make sure our graduates are employable and successful as they walk out the door. But Dr. Kulkarni, Dr. Morris, Dr. Reed running those centers, and Dr. Pellen Cohn is going to be our first director of our leadership center. So those four centers really are going to bring a really an incredible level of agility and relevance to Norwich going forward.
Dr. Mark Anarumo was inaugurated as Norwich University's 24th president last Wednesday. President Anarumo, congratulations, and thanks so much for being on the program this morning.
Rick, thanks for having me. I'll come on any time.
All right, great. Our pleasure. We've got the top of the hour CBS News up next, and we'll be back to hear what's going on around the world and the country from national correspondent Bob Ney. And coming up this afternoon at 1, it's Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, followed by 2 hours of The Getaway with Greg Hooker. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. National correspondent Bob Ney joins us now, and we're going to get an update on what's happening around the world and the country. Bob, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning, Bob. All right, let's start off and take a look at the COVID numbers.
Well, worldwide, the total deaths are 4,778,289. Our deaths have increased in the United States. Remember when it was 600,000, Rick? Well, yes. Now it's 695,957 people, so it's going to be at some point in time toppling 700,000 some. I think the details, the daily cases, tells a little bit varied story, hopefully on a good side. Mm-hmm. But the daily cases, the current seven-day average of cases decreased 17.1%. So the daily average is 121,000 cases. So that's better than when we talked last time. The vaccinations are interesting. People that are older, of course, they're getting vaccinated, we know, more. Basically, 64% of the total U.S. population have received at least one dose of the vaccine. And then again, in the category of the more senior people, it can go up to 82%, so they're getting more of the vaccinations. And then the hospital admissions, and those current seven-day average since you and I talked last week for September 15th through the 21st was 9,636. That is a 14.4 decrease. Now, we all know stories about horrible situations in Columbus, Ohio, Chicago, et cetera, about hospital beds and intensive care unit beds, but these are general statistics for the United States. So there's a decrease, but there's a problem in certain, cities. And then the death, the current seven-day moving average of new deaths, 1,557, has increased 0.7%. compared with the week before.
Mm. And Bob, we're heading into the colder months when we go back inside around each other in tighter places.
Quarters,
so
yeah.
Will we see that rise again that we saw last year?
Well, I mean, I think we will, and we're going to see peaks and then some valleys and some of the leveling out of this. But it also depends on other variants. It depends on how many more people become vaccinated. Mm-hmm. It depends on transmission from kids that, are at school. The thing is, mask up, wash your hands a lot. If you can get vaccinated, get vaccinated, get the booster shot. Those are things that they're stressing. But beyond the shots, it's going to be really important. Keep your hands away from your face, your nose, your ears, and your mouth. And make sure you wash your hands a lot and try to mask up, especially if you don't know people, you're around people that you don't know.
And everything we've been told for the last year and a half, not the most difficult, stringent asks, so really should be fairly easy to do those things.
Well, and I think, Rick, we're in better shape than, last year when you and I started talking about this. We're in better shape, but we could be in much better shape if we just – I know people are tired of this, sure, yeah. But if we can just bear through this a little bit more and try to follow the game plan, it should get better.
All right. Let's turn our attention to President Biden. And first of all, one thing that I know caught your attention are China tariffs. So tell us about what his plan is there.
Yes, I've rather been obsessed with this for 24 years, I must say. I used to do press conferences with Bernie Sanders and Dennis Kucinich of Ohio and Congressman Biondi of New Jersey. I can go down a list of people. We did press conferences together 30 years ago about China and about tariffs and about unfair trade practices. And finally, President Trump came in and really was the first president in modern times that actually did what he said he was going to do. He was going to go after the Chinese with tariffs. Now, American mm-hmm. international companies don't like that, and they'll argue they're hurting jobs here. But at the end, we were losing jobs anyway due to Chinese, basic slave labor in China. So when President Biden came in, companies behind the scenes very quietly said, okay, this is going to roll back. He's going to roll back all the tariffs. Well, we know from yesterday that the tariffs that Trump put on are basically starting points. The Biden's trade rep, Mrs. Tsai, said that it's going to be starting points they're going to go from. So it was kind of a shocking announcement, I think, for China yesterday. But what basically President Biden is saying is, I'm going to start from where President Trump left off. Let's take it from there. I think it's a great strategy move. I think it shows China that President Biden is going to be tough. And frankly, the Chinese government really only understands aggression, and that's when they'll back off. If President Biden would have removed the tariffs, China would have said, okay, we're going to start from down here. President Biden's taking the bar a little bit higher on this one.
Interesting. All right, let's look the other way to our east and our relationship with the European Union, strained a bit by that deal we came up with Australia. So what does Biden do now?
Well, it's strained with Australia. We have a little particular problem with Erdogan, the president of Turkey, because he violated sanctions. He was part of a deal for F-35s, and now we've kicked him out of that. He's angry about it, but he was buying missiles from Russia. And the reason Turkey is pivotable is because it is between Europe and the Mideast. It's the country that's kind of, you know, in between there, and we've used it as military base for us, but they're angry at us over supporting the Kurds. So, you know, that doesn't control the entire European Union, obviously, but it's a big integral part that's important for Europe and important for us. As far as the European Union itself, there's not going to be a divorce here, but there's just a lot of strain. You know, France is angry at the deal because they lost some sales to Australia, yet Australia has kind of been going between us and China, and so now I think it puts Australia more into our category. So we'll get through it. The European Union is straining a little bit anyway. They're having, you know, a change of government in Germany and ongoing problems dealing with Brexit in the United Kingdom. But overall, look, it's Europe. It's us. We're going to be allies.
Yeah. All right. Let's move domestically. The debt ceiling, we almost had a shutdown. It was avoided. What happened there, and how long do we have to breathe before this happens again?
Well, it was avoided, as you and I had spoke before, as we kind of predicted it would be avoided, which was a, you know, continuing spending resolution with no debt ceiling. So that's what they did. Basically kicking it down to December, but the 18th is, you know, when the government starts to have to shift money, so they'll have talks, you know, before that point in time. Debt ceiling vote used to be an easy vote. You're paying for something you already voted for last year, but, you know, it's become a difficult vote. So Schumer tried his best to get the debt ceiling. McConnell wasn't going to cooperate, the Republican leader. So they made this compromise, and we just continued, you know, to spend till December. And it really has nothing to do with the $1.2 trillion infrastructure or the $3.5 trillion. It just happened to be a problem out there at the same time. So they will continue to talk. Look, an election year, they all do cooperate. Nobody wants to be the party that shuts the government down in an election year, which is coming up in January.
Yeah, good point. Now, speaking of the infrastructure bill, still not approved yet. You and I thought this was going to happen before the reconciliation bill kind of tied to it. So where are things right now, Bob?
Well, the speaker tried to bring a vote last night on the floor of the House, and the progressives are very angry. They want the $3.5 trillion. Now, they passed it, but they want it from the Senate, which is the other body, and which has a problem because Senator Schumer, the leader of the Democrats in the Senate, has two senators, and there's a little bit more, but two senators, Manchin and Sinema, who are saying they're not voting for it. Well, if you take 50 minus 2, simple math tells you you have 48 votes, you need 50. There are not 50 votes for $3.5 trillion. Yesterday, Senator Manchin, I think his office probably did this, leaked out that he told them this summer the best he'll do is $1.5 trillion. He told them. So I don't know how they continue to argue. They, meaning the progressives in the House, continue to argue. I mean, they've got to push their point, but what do they expect Speaker Pelosi to do? She can't make Senator Manchin reverse himself, you know.
Right. Can't or Senator Sinema. And you and I have focused a lot on Manchin, but what can you tell us about the senator from Arizona?
Well, you're raising a really good question because we've all focused on Manchin. He's been the face out front. He's been the face of, you know, I'm going to hold this down fiscally. But the real reality of this is even if Senator Manchin did a deal tomorrow, Senator Sinema from Arizona is not going to do that. She's somebody who's not like Manchin. He throws his cards out there. Here's where I'm at. She's somebody that keeps her opinions very close to the vest, doesn't care whether she has to share them or not, quite independent, and she's not going to go along with it. So yeah, you're right. Nobody's focused on her. Even if they get past Manchin, they have to get past her, and it's going to be hard.
Yeah, still need 50.
And facts of life.
Yeah, that's both right. Of them, West Virginia and Arizona. Definitely any bills are going through those two states right now. All right, let's look down to the border. Looks like a surge again there on the border, Bob?
Yes, there's a warning from Panama that a lot of Haitians have went through. Panama's been giving food and comfort and, you know, some shelter to them, and they passed through. But it looks like the numbers they're quoting, I don't know, I want to say, Rick, I don't know if this is accurate, but Panama's quoting 60,000 some people are heading to the U.S.-Mexico border. If that happens, it's going to pale the 10,000 that were down in Rio at the border. So we'll have to see, but that's what Panama is warning the United Nations, that, you know, there's going to be a surge and a crisis of upwards of 60,000 some people. So we need to stay tuned and see what happens. It will be a dilemma for the Biden administration, no question about it. 10,000 was a problem. If it ranges 40, 50, or 60,000, it's going to be a huge issue.
As president, crises, dilemmas, always happening. Bob, it makes me wonder, did you ever consider running for president of the United States?
Well, like every senator, you know, every morning they look in the mirror and they say, "Good morning, Mr. President." That's what we used to say in the House. There's a lot of House jokes. Right. But yes, at one time I thought about it, and then I aimed towards Speaker of the House, and of course that all blew up. So now I'm on radio and flipping houses, and I'm okay. It's not a good time to be president. I like what I'm doing better than being in the White House.
Well done, Bob Ney. All right. National correspondent Bob Ney, thank you so much for being with us this week.
Thank you, Rick.
All right. Talk to you next week. If there's some story that's been passed down through the ages by your family, it might be worth doing some digging to learn more. That's what happened in Virgins, and an interesting part of Vermont history was discovered. Here to tell us about that is Dan Bowles of 7 Days. Dan, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick. Happy to be here.
Great. Now, this is one of those stories that, Dan, with each paragraph I've read of your story, I became more and more enthralled. So I hope to maintain some order on how we tell the story this morning. But let's start with Stephen Bates, who served as Virgin's sheriff and police chief. So give us some background on who Stephen Bates was.
Sure. So I think to kind of fully understand who Stephen Bates was, it helps to remember some recent history. I'm sure folks recall last summer when Brian Peet was sworn in as Montpelier's chief of police, and it was believed that he was the first black chief of police in Vermont history. But it turned out that Stephen Bates actually preceded him by more than 140 years. In 1879, he became Vermont's first black sheriff and chief of police, and he served for about 25 years after that.
And was that a position that was held simultaneously? Were they two separate positions?
They were simultaneously held. I think his official title was sheriff, but he also oversaw, you know, what police force Virgins had at the time.
All right. So where did he come from? You know, where did Stephen Bates come? He wasn't originally from Virgins. So let's go back in his history a bit.
Sure. So Stephen Bates was born into slavery on a plantation in Virginia. That plantation was actually owned by the grandparents of Robert E. Lee. And in his later years, when he was in Virginia, he would actually tell you know, his friends and neighbors, you know, these vivid memories that he had of General Lee and some other pretty prominent Southerners. He was a waiter, I guess, at the plantation, so he was kind of having a lot of face time with these pretty prominent folks in the South. So he, during the Civil War, was able to escape with his brothers from the plantation. He ended up hooking up with some Union Army folks, and it's not entirely clear, but the thinking is that he marched with the Union Army from Virginia to Washington, D.C., which is where he met a guy named Woodbridge, Frederick Woodbridge.
Mm-hmm. And then what gets him from Washington, D.C. to us here in Vergennes, Vermont?
So Frederick Woodbridge was a congressman from Vermont. He lived in Vergennes. The Woodbridges at the time were one of the wealthiest families, if not the wealthiest family in Vermont. So he it's unclear exactly how he connected with Woodbridge, but Woodbridge hired him as his coach driver. And they took a real liking to each other. And when Woodbridge's tenure in Congress ended, Stephen Bates ended up coming back to Vergennes with Woodbridge, moved into a tiny little house right next to his in downtown Vergennes. And then I think it was a year after they moved back to Vergennes, Woodbridge ran for mayor, and he basically put up Frederick Bates as a candidate for sheriff, and they both won.
Wow. Now, how was Bates regarded by those in the Vergennes community as a sheriff and a police chief?
So this is kind of the cool thing. You know, a lot of folks have done some research to sort of sort out what kind of person he was. You know, journalism back then wasn't really like it is today. Like, you're not getting these, like, long Vanity Fair style pieces where you really learn about people. So they've had to piece together kind of what they can based on a number of different newspaper reports and different writings. So the thinking is that he was really well liked. We have some empirical evidence to that. I mean, he was the sheriff at the time was an annual position. You had to run every year. When he ran for the second year, he won unanimously. And in pretty much every election after that, he either won by huge margins or ran unopposed. So he seemed to be really well liked. He was described as a very cool customer, but you definitely didn't want to be on the wrong side of the law. He was pretty firm about that too. So all indications are that that he was a pillar of the community, and his family was really, really well loved here.
I am still gobsmacked by the fact that he was born into slavery, served the family of Robert E. Lee, would have interacted with General Lee, and then winds up being the first police chief and sheriff in the state of Vermont. As you mentioned, when Brian Peete was hired as police chief in Montpelier, we all assumed that he was the first African-American to hold that position. So why didn't we know about Stephen Bates?
That's a great question. And the interesting thing is that, you know, Stephen Bates was not entirely lost to history. In speaking with some folks here in Vergennes, he was actually taught, like his life story was taught in Vergennes schools. And he's been included in some, you know, roundups of prominent black Vermonters and New Englanders over the years. But for whatever reason, his story just kind of, you know, fell out of view for the last few decades. And it wasn't really until his great-grandson, a guy named Larry Schuyler, who lived in Worcester, Massachusetts, was doing some family research and happened to uncover that his great-grandfather was very likely the first black sheriff in Vermont, and possibly some historians even think he might have been the first in New England as well.
Right. What do we know if there were any other black police chiefs or sheriffs in the country who might have preceded Bates in that role?
So from what I could gather, there most likely were. There were, particularly in the South during Reconstruction, there were black police chiefs in predominantly black areas in the South. Records are a little scattered, and that's actually been kind of a big part of this story, particularly for black people at the time. There just weren't a lot of records kept, which definitely provided kind of a hurdle for Larry to research his great-grandfather. So it's very likely that there were in other parts of the country black sheriffs, but it's also possible that he was pretty sure he was the first in Vermont, and possible he was the first in New England.
All right. What has it been like? You mentioned Larry Schuyler, the great-grandson. What has it been like for him to learn and to confirm the stories that his family has been passing on for generations?
He likened it to opening Pandora's box. There has just been this flood of information that has come from it. So he knew kind of through family folklore that his great-grandfather had been a lawman in Vermont. But the idea that he would have been the first black sheriff in the state never occurred to him until he started digging in. So he had reached out to folks at a church in Virgins where his great-grandfather was a member, and they kind of helped him start doing some digging in archives at the church and in newspaper records in Vermont. And the whole thing kind of snowballed and became kind of a community effort in Vermont where a bunch of people got involved, all doing bits and pieces of research and kind of helping to piece together Stephen Bates' story.
And how is Virgins commemorating the legacy of Stephen Bates?
So there will be an historical marker that is going in Virgin City Park right downtown on Sunday morning. It'll be right next to the church that Bates was a member of. And then there's also an exhibit at the Bixby Library just down the street in Virgins that'll be up, I believe, through the fall. And there's also a significant online component that will be available, I believe, starting tomorrow and then through, you know, for as long as online things exist, I guess. So.
I want to give a nod to the Bixby, one of the beautiful libraries you'll find in the state. And I don't know if they still have it, but they used to have this wonderful little local history museum in the library upstairs. And if it's still open, a great thing to go and see. In your story, Dan, you mentioned the fact that the Bates house burned down. What was known about that?
So it's unclear what exactly happened. We do know that the house burned, and everything that the Bates owned, for the most part, was destroyed in the fire. But the local fire department was able to save the house. It's unclear how the fire started. It's possible that it could have just been, you know, a clogged stovepipe or something. House fires were really, really common back in that day. You know, you think of all the buildings were made of wood. We didn't have the same kind of heating technologies and safety measures that we have now. So house fires were not uncommon. However, Larry Schuyler believes that his great-grandfather and his family were victims of arson, which is also probably not terribly difficult to imagine that, you know, a black family in a predominantly white community at the time could be the victims of arson. But the postscript to the story is that the town of Virgins rallied around the Bateses. They raised a ton of money to kind of get them back on their feet and rebuild their home. And that's really the part of the story that that Larry thinks is most important.
Absolutely. Dan, how does it feel for you to be able to share such an important and heretofore unknown piece of Vermont history?
It's pretty cool. There has, you know, there's been some interest in Sheriff Bates and his life recently. Kind of the marker team, the folks who really got the historical marker project rolling have done a great job of trying to get his story out there. Also, as a personal side note, I moved to Virgins about a year ago, so it's been really neat to kind of have a front row seat to some living or some great history in Vermont.
Oh, that's so cool. Tell us a little bit. We got about a minute left, but, you know, give a plug for, the smallest city in America, Virgins.
It is an absolutely great little town. There's a surprising amount going on here. Downtown is wonderful, and the neighbors are great. And you really can't beat Addison County. It's I've lived in Burlington for a long time and loved it there. But it's a little bit of a different pace of life, lifestyle down here, and I'm really, really enjoying it.
Yeah, and I think food, Park Squeeze, and Virgin's Laundry, and a few of the other places. You still have the Chocolatier down there.
Oh. Daily Chocolate, sure.
Sounds great. All right. You can find Dan's story about Stephen Bates in this week's edition of 7 Days or online at 7daysvt.com. Dan, thanks so much for sharing this bit of history.
Thank you, Rick. My pleasure.
All right. We'll be back after a special CBS News report, and then we will be wandering around Burlington with Thea Lewis on a Queen City ghost walk. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. They move in packs throughout Vermont's largest city. They love when it gets dark and there's a crispness in the air. And they love hearing tales of mystery and imagination and a bit of creepiness. They're the folks going on a Queen City ghost walk with one of their guides. And here to tell us about those wonderful walks is the author and historian Thea Lewis. Thea, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. How are you doing today?
Oh, I'm great. How about you?
I'm doing really well. It's October 1st, and I, you know, even though I think about Halloween and this kind of fall season a lot of the time during the year, I'm pretty much all ghost tour all the time once it gets to be October 1st.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you get, like, really excited at this time of year to share this history of Burlington with people?
I really do. Our tours start in normal years, non-COVID years. Our tours usually start in July. And as we've added more and different tours, it's really gratifying to be able to tell people not just about Burlington's haunted history, the history of a lot of our buildings architecturally, but now that we're doing the true crime Burlington tours, we're throwing a lot of other interesting aspects into the mix.
Well, I love it. Hey, listeners, if you've got a question about Burlington's beguiling history, or if you've been on one of Thea's ghost walks, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, so what will someone experience when they're on a Queen City ghost walk?
On a Queen City Ghost Walk tour, well, there are different tours. We have a Darkness Falls tour, which is a loose circle around Burlington's downtown. A lot of really interesting history of the movers and shakers that created Burlington so many years ago. But we also have on Wednesday nights, what we're calling this year our Grateful Wednesdays, and that's my Ghosts and Legends of Lake Champlain tour, which is based on some of the stories from my book with the same name, but also some very interesting stories that I learned while writing another book called Wicked Vermont. Mm-hmm. So that's another offering we have. And we do cemetery tours, too, where we visit the stones of people who were interred, who really meant a lot to the city of Burlington. People like Horatio Nelson Jackson, who made the first cross-country trip by automobile and was a citizen of the city of Burlington. We walk among the stones, and I tell the stories of the folks who are interred there, their lives, and then the haunted tales of the buildings they either lived or worked in or created when they lived in Burlington back in the day.
I know you love all of your tours like one loves all of their children the same, but you have a new book out about Burlington's Lakeview Cemetery, and you have, I think those come up, the tours on the 10th, 17th, and 24th of this month through Lakeview Cemetery. So that's got to be particularly exciting for you right now.
Absolutely. We usually try to do Elmwood Cemetery, which is a very old cemetery, interments going back to the 1700s in Burlington. But Lakeview is so special because it's one of those cemeteries that's called a lawn park cemetery. And lawn park cemeteries back in the 1800s were places where people went to, not just to remember their dead, but to enjoy recreation. People, after a long week, you know, they would maybe go to church on Sunday and then pack a picnic lunch, head to the cemetery, spread a blanket, talk with their neighbors, gossip a little bit. And Lakeview, with its incredible variety of trees and ornamental plantings and its view of Lake Champlain, is, a place where a lot of people joke people are dying to get in, but it's a really wonderful cemetery and just a fun walk on a ghost walk and just great to walk through any time of year, really.
Do you take a picnic out there sometimes and just go hang out at that cemetery?
I have to tell you, I cannot tell a lie. When I was writing the book about Lakeview Cemetery, I would often drive my car down into the cemetery and get out and do the research among the stones and get back in my car and eat a little picnic lunch of things I'd bought at the deli at the local supermarket. It might be a shrimp cocktail sitting on the dashboard of my ghost mobile. You just never knew. I'd just be sitting in the car, looking at all the trees, looking out at the lake, and thinking about the folks who may or may not be joining me.
All right, we don't think that's weird for you, Thea. We actually expect you to do this, so I think that's really cool. Who are some noteworthy people that are buried there at Lakeview Cemetery?
In Lakeview Cemetery, we've got people like Brevet Major General William Wells, most decorated Civil War figure. He has a statue in Burlington's Battery Park and a statue on the battlefield at Gettysburg. Horatio Nelson Jackson, who made the first cross-country trip by automobile with his dog Bud. And we've got John J. Flynn, who created the Flynn Theater. And I mean, the list goes on and on. There's Socrates Beach, who was a he owned a baking company in Burlington. He was a local philanthropist. He in earlier years, and then John J. Flynn in later years, were very concerned with taking care of some of the more recreational aspects of lives of children in Burlington. Times were hard in the early part of the 1900s. There were kids who were maybe 6-7 years old who were walking around selling newspapers on the street late at night. I mean, there were not a lot of rules in the early 1900s about when or how children worked, but they were people who provided small treats for children around the holidays, and I love talking about that.
Oh, I like that. Who was Philomene Lemoyne?
Philomene Lemoyne. Yes, Philomene Lemoyne is definitely featured in the book. I talk about her on our downtown tours, both in the Darkness Falls tour a little bit, but in a bigger way in my new true crime tours, which happen on Thursday nights. Philomene Lemoyne was a lady of the evening. Actually, she was the supreme madam back in her day.
Uh-huh.
She was a person who ran what they called a house of ill fame, and she did it for more than three decades in the city of Burlington. She was a force to be reckoned with.
Oh, I bet. All right. So when someone goes on one of the Queen City Ghost Walk tours, how long do they tend to last?
Well, they vary a little bit in length. The True Crime Tour is just chock full of historic and more modern murders we talk about. That's about an hour and a half long. It's been clocking in. Last night's True Crime Tour was about an hour and 27, so it's pretty true. Mm-hmm. The Darkness Falls Tour and the Ghosts and Legends of Lake Champlain are probably about an hour and 15. The cemetery tour is usually a little bit shorter, around an hour, but I notice that people are not really interested in lingering so much in the cemetery after dark.
Why, Thea? Why? I don't get that.
I don't know. It's hard to. I do provide flashlights, so that's not it at all.
All right.
Yeah.
Now, and how many people tend to be on a tour at a time?
We are being, present day, as opposed to how the tours used to be back in 2009, is very different. It used to get to be a couple of weeks before Halloween, and it would not be unusual to have a tour with maybe 45 people. But what we've been trying to do this season is just kind of observe extraordinary care during this time when people are worried about their health. We are topping out our Halloween tours probably at about 35 people. We want to give people some breathing room, even though we're outdoors. We're just trying to hold the line. We want to make sure that even though the tour is all outdoors, that people are still able to distance themselves. And even though I don't wear a mask for the tour itself, I do greet people as we're in that space with me taking tickets of 1 or 2 feet. I'm scanning people's tickets. I greet people masked. And then as I am able to move back, as the tour begins, the mask comes off, and there I am, for better or worse.
And you must really need to project, I would think, to make sure people are catching everything.
I want to let people know that during our tours, and this is something a couple of years ago, a gentleman thanked me at the end of a tour. I do use amplification. Back in the old days, 20 years ago, I think when I was younger, I was a little louder. I was able to project a little more than I do. But I do have a microphone. I do have amplification. People, I check with people. I ask them if they're able to hear me just fine. Mm-hmm. And when they say yes, I feel good about that. I think it's important, especially during our downtown tours, because there are people dining, a lot more people dining outside now. There's
right.
traffic, the occasional ambulance, you know, so yeah, there's a lot going on.
And I understand that the tours often sell out. So how far in advance should somebody plan to be able to get a ticket for one of the tours?
People should be thinking this week of when they want to grab their posse, their gang, whoever their friends are who want to go on a Queen City Ghost Walk or a true crime tour. For one thing, there aren't going to be many of them left.
Right.
When we're finished in October, we're finished. We may, depending on the weather, we may offer a few true crime in November, but that's not a given. We just never know. So right now, I can say that tours near the end of the month. Halloween is booking up.
Wow.
We've got a glow stick necklace night. That is definitely booking up. We're getting to the point where some of the tours are maybe two-thirds full near the end of the month, and we still have good availability for next week's tours, and but climbing the week after that.
Yeah,
so
I bet.
People just want to we do want to stress that it's not a situation where you can count on. It used to be that we would accept walk-ups probably as a matter of course, but that is not going to be happening this year. If we've got a full tour, if we're fully booked, then we're going to have to disappoint some people, and we hate to do that. So I'm really encouraging people to go ahead and book early.
Now, this isn't something, a normal line of work for most people, Thea. So how did you get into the Ghost Walk Tour business in the first place?
It is the craziest thing. I went in 2001 on a visit to Salem, Massachusetts. I had never been on a ghost tour before. And the tour I went on had so much fascinating history. And driving back to Burlington, I thought, why doesn't Burlington have a tour like this? And so a friend was kind enough to loan me some books that were they're called Historic Guide to Burlington Neighborhoods, and there are several volumes. And I started reading about the history of the buildings. And wherever I would go, whether it was a cocktail party or a political event, people would say, hey, how's it going? And what are you up to? And I would tell them what I was up to in my work. And then I'd mention that I was planning a haunted tour, and the first year was just 1 week. Well, you wouldn't believe how people would just practically leap over their dinner companions or whoever was next to them to say, well, you know, this place is haunted and you know, that place is haunted. And so once I had just a passel of stories that went with the interesting places, in Burlington that dated back to, often the, 1800s, there's a question of dovetailing the anecdotal evidence with the places. And I have to tell you, there are a lot of places that I just discounted stories out of hand. You'd go back and look at the research, and sometimes things just don't add up. But for me, that's okay, because I believe every ghost story you can debunk makes the ones you can't that much scarier.
So what story is it in all your tours that really kind of creeps you out, that you think, oh, man, it's the big one here in Burlington?
Oh gosh, well,
and I know you love them all.
I love them all, but the one that really seems to, the one that endlessly fascinates me. There are two that fascinate me. One is American Flatbread, which was the old Carber's restaurant.
Yeah.
And which was a building that was owned by a smuggler named Gideon King back in the 1800s. And it is thought that Gideon King may have used that space to hide some of the things he was smuggling back during a time when we had a trade embargo going on. And the other location is the beautiful Follett House, the Palmerlough Real Estate Agency.
Oh, yeah, it's beautiful.
Which is, you know, was lovingly restored, almost lost. It was a VFW back in the 1970s, and it was not up to code. The city wanted to get rid of it, and that would have been a crime, I think. It's got an amazing architectural pedigree, and I just love bringing people there. And I'd have to say that's my favorite haunt in the city of Burlington, a place where many times guests will get back to me and send me photos of strange, unexplainable things in the windows, and where even folks who have worked there over the last two decades I've been doing these tours have talked to me. Antonio Palmerlough told me ghost stories.
No kidding.
You know, some of the first ghost stories I got were from him and from other people in the building. So it's a wonderful place. We're lucky to have it from either just a architectural or haunted perspective.
I love it. All right, let's get a little specific on some of them. What is the Darkness Falls tour?
So the Darkness Falls tour is a tour that mixes. Let's see, we've got places like the Follett House. We talk about serial killers in the city of Burlington and what they may have wrought while they were here. People like H.H. Holmes. Travel around in a loose circle in Burlington. There's a little bit of talk of ghosts on St. Paul Street. Really a mixed bag. And then the ghosts and legends of Lake Champlain. We deal with everything from ghost ships to Champ to the fact that our Burlington's Harbor and Burlington seem to be a magnet for ghosts. For UFO activity. We've got documented UFO sightings, and we do on that tour talk a bit about Philomene Lemoyne and some other legends like Gideon King and the Hermit of Champlain. And there's a brand new tour this year. We've got another brand new tour this year. It's a tour for kids that's going to be conducted in Lakeview Cemetery. It's called Fright by Flashlight. And there are only three tours, and space is limited. But this is a tour for kids and their adventurous parents where they can come and experience some old-fashioned ghost investigating, things that people used to use back in the 1800s and early 1900s before we had all the fancy ghost gizmos that people use today, you know, all the meters and things. We employ bells and compasses, and Fright by Flashlight is just going to be a kind of a fun tour where kids can come listen to some ghost stories, learn some history in the cemetery. And I think it's going to be a good time for, for people of all ages.
How neat. I'll give the website in case people want to check that out, queencityghostwalk.com. Now, you mentioned H.H. Holmes. Isn't he the character in that wonderful book, Devil in the White City?
He is, the Eric Larson book, which is a fantastic book. I believe it won the Pulitzer Prize. And it's just one of these books that manages to, in such a beautiful way, not only detail the nefarious deeds of H.H. Holmes, but also talk about that wonderful Chicago World's Fair in 1893, that White City. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of fascinating aspects of that World's Fair that I wasn't aware of until I read the book. I really recommend it to anyone who is interested in history.
You and me both. Francis Law Olmsted did the grounds. It was where the Ferris wheel was first unveiled. But, it's a fabulous book. Oh, my gosh.
Really great.
And H.H. Holmes did have a connection to Burlington that you'll find out on one of Thea's tours. All right. How much fun is it for you to host these ghost walk tours?
Oh, it's so much fun. It's, the people are always, they're in such a great mood. They're so much fun to be with. It's never the same tour twice for me, even if I'm doing, I've been doing these, every fall and, for the last 10 years, summer and fall. since 2002. Our 20-year anniversary is next year. And I just really enjoy, for instance, last night on our true crime tour, there's one particular place, I'm not going to say its name, but it's in Burlington's downtown. A horrifying murder happened there in the 1980s. And some, you know, when I said the name of the place, people began to get excited. And then after the tour, a young man came up to me and he said, I can't believe I now know the story because I've heard people call this place this certain thing for years, you know, like all my, like half my life. And I had no idea. And so, it's just nice to be able to spread history, no matter which tour it is, and tell people a story, a good story. That's what the walks are about.
I am so intrigued about the True Crimes Thursday tour now. You've written a handful of books. Does the research for the books help you with the tour, or has your research for the tours turned into the books?
Well, absolutely. It's the research for the tours turned into the books back in 2008. No, actually, early 2009, a managing editor from the History Press, which is my publisher, they're under the umbrella of Arcadia Publishing, sent me an email and said, hey there, we are looking for someone to write a book called Haunted Burlington. We discovered your tours. Could you write a book for us? And I right away spoke with my husband and I said, these people want me to write a book. How can I do that? I mean, at that point we had three kids living in the house. They were, you know, like three kids under the age of 13.
Oh my.
And I had a 60-hour-a-week job. And he said, haven't you always wanted to write a book? And I said, yes. And he said, well, how could you not? How could you say no? So he picked up the slack for me. And that was how I wrote Haunted Burlington, Spirits of Vermont's Queen City. With and the starting place was different stops on my tours. And then I spread out to include some other places in Burlington. And so, yeah, with each book, with each book, there comes research. And then the, I guess as it started out, the tours informed the books, but now sometimes it's the other way around. As with, Wicked Vermont, a lot, you know, there are stories, on the True Crime Tour that came from researching for that book.
Mm. Author and historian Thea Lewis owns Queen City Ghost Walk Tours and has written five books, including her latest, Lakeview Cemetery in Burlington, Vermont. And you can learn more, get tickets, queencityghostwalk.com. Thea, it has been a wonderful adventure as always. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, take care. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint was directed by Peter Cormier. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at WDEVradio.com. Common Sense Radio is up next with Bill Sayre. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday.